This is Michaela J., the voice of the corporation, and you're listening to SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
I'm talking about a big coincidence.
There's the holy moment, and then there's the awareness of trying to have the holy moment. In the same way that the film is the actual moment really happening, but then the character pretending to be in a different reality. And it's all these layers.
We think everything is separate, limited. I'm over here, you're over there, which is true. But it's not the whole truth, because we're all connected.
The time as of now is now. And you are listening to Synchronize, the weekly audio magazine exploring and highlighting the best in the synchronistic arts. Please set your minds to open.
Open the pod bay doors.
Hello, this is Alan Abadesa Green. And you may be wondering why we're doing a show about March 17th in July. Truth be told, we weren't so sure why we were doing this either. The main interview with Michael Schacht was recorded back on May 3rd, and the contribution from Zenor was sent to us on June 10th. This episode should have long been done, but it was waiting on my audio essay, and I had some strange mental block about finishing it. Then it hit me, the reason why this episode wasn't ready to come out, what it was we were waiting on. July 23rd, today, is the anniversary of Robert Anton Wilson's Sirius experience, which we touched on in the last episode of Synchronize with the segment on Music of the Spheres. While Sirius is never far from my mind, it seems in some way important to this episode in particular, though it is only touched on tangentially. We will likely discover the further significance of this at a later date. For now, let us begin with guest Michael Schacht. Michael is the author of the blog Gosporn, which you can find at gosporn.blogspot.com. He also contributed a chapter to SyncBook Volume 1. Michael is a wonderful writer and a great personal friend. He also plays the role of guardian angel to me in the dream world. For some reason, ever since I met Michael and his husband in person a few years ago, they appear in my dreams whenever I feel lost or in some strange, unfamiliar territory. I would like to thank Michael for all his work, his years of friendship, and for appearing on Synchronize. Hello, Michael, and welcome to Synchronize.
Hello, Alan. Thank you. It's great to be here.
In your chapter for SyncBook Volume 1, an essay entitled Porn Star Jesus, it deals with the Jungian idea that whenever a subconscious archetype is suppressed or denied, it becomes a shadow or dark side. Can you speak to this?
Well, I've been fascinated by that for a really long time. I think it's basically, I use a lot of my own personal upbringing in a, I wouldn't call it a fundamentalist church, but it was darn close. It was Presbyterian, but the pastor was definitely had a fundamentalist bent, and he was very anti-gay. And then my whole coming out process, and then accepting my own self, and what the revelation, and I use that word deliberately, that it was, that gay is okay on a cosmic level. And that, so I'm really fascinated by that whole subject, obviously. That's basically, yeah, where I started blogging was about this so-called dark side that was called homosexuality from the church. And what did that mean to me as a gay man and as someone who, you know, believed in Jesus as my savior? And does that mean that I couldn't have Jesus as my savior? And it kind of all went from there.
On your blog, you describe your avatar as a gay man reconciling his God and his cock. What are the correlations between the two?
Well, some would say none, and I would say pretty much everything, because your cock is your, what I call your Eros, your base Kundalini the base of the Kundalini, the source of all power in the universe, according to many myths, is the base of your Kundalini, which is, of course, your erotic desire and nature. So if you want to think of God as all powerful, or however you want to think of this concept of a male God, it really has to start with his phallus, a creative force in the universe. And I happen to have a phallus, so, and I'm kind of attached to it. And I'm really interested in the fact that, of course, on one hand, erotic desire is completely scandalized and denied by most modern religions. But I also see how ancient religions have a very strong tradition of accepting and looking at the erotic nature of humanity.
So what happens when we deny this essential aspect? Going back to that Jungian idea, what happens when we deny this essential erotic element of ourselves?
Well, according to Jung, what happens is this nature becomes goes into denial, and which is a wonderful pun, because in the Egyptian myth, Osiris is attacked and killed by Set. Set, to me, represents our subconscious or dark side, and his body is cut into 14 parts and thrown into the Nile or denial. And so everything that's in denial is literally in the Nile and underwater. And so when this happens, it becomes, we see it as a negative, evil aspect of ourselves that has to be pushed down, again, this underwater kind of idea. But it is literally part of us, so it cannot be pushed down, and it comes up in extremely inappropriate, shocking behavior.
You mentioned shocking. There's a strange synchronicity around you, Michael Schacht, and the singer, Michelle Schacht, who made a bit of a stir on St. Patrick's Day.
So it's not too late. You can jump into this Jesus gang anytime you want. But I was in a prayer meeting yesterday, and you got to appreciate how scared folks on that side of the equation are. I mean, from their vantage point, and I really shouldn't say there, because it's mine too, we are nearly at the end of time. And from our vantage point, we're going to be... I think maybe Chinese water torture is going to be the method. Once Prop 8 gets instated, and once preachers are held at gunpoint and forced to marry the homosexuals, I'm pretty sure that that will be the signal for Jesus to come on back. You said you wanted reality. If someone would be so gracious as to please tweet out, Michelle Schacht just said from stage, God hates faggots. Would you do it now?
You can have your show, Michelle.
I think some people's gods.
Just adjusting my bra strap. Nothing worth getting the froth over. They're confounded. Matt, you might need to come back up here.
There's going to be a lot of talking about that.
I ain't scared.
Can you talk about what she said and what you make of the sync around your almost identically sounding names?
Fun, isn't it? Well, the first really interesting sync about it is that it was on St. Patrick's Day, which is... which is also called Osiris Day by, you know, the synchronistic crowd, and because it represents this same Egyptian idea of a green man, and but So the very fact that she said this on 317 was really interesting to me. And she was 51 years old when she said that. Well, 51 is 3 times 17. And I've also noticed how how the 501 genes are kind of the trademark genes of the whole gay culture that happened in the 70s. You know, gays in San Francisco basically made the 501 gene popular. It's iconic by now. So these 17 and 51 are extremely important numbers to me. So we have Michelle Schacht, who's 51, on 317, talking about this. And what she said was, well, this is what's reported. Okay, but she made a basic, this huge anti-gay rant. And she said, if California's Proposition 8, which effectively bans gay marriage, is overturned, it will be the downfall of civilization and Jesus will come back, unquote. Which is wild. It's nutty. It's,
certainly.
It's a rant.
But tying that into the idea of Osiris as this dead and resurrected god, and the return of Jesus is pretty astounding.
Right. And the fact that she says it will be the downfall of civilization and Jesus will come back, and she's talking as if that's a negative thing. But of course she's also a Christian, and aren't Christians supposed to be looking forward to the second coming? And then the civilization aspect is fascinating because Egypt is supposed to be the cradle of civilization. But if you've ever read something like, say, Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, you get a much more nuanced idea of what civilization really is. And we live in an extremely over-civilized world, and it wouldn't be such a bad thing if civilization retreated a little bit and we got a little wilder.
So that's great, because so many on spiritual paths tend to turn away or blush or outright scandalize sexuality. Even straight sex is thought of as somehow dirty or impure. But I know that you see a need to acknowledge our sexual sides, and this is one of the reasons I think your contribution to this community is so valuable. Can you speak to this a little more?
Well, I guess that's just the part that really fascinates me about my own path, because of course I am a homosexual. Therefore my sexuality is defining me. I'm letting it define me, but it's also been defined for me. But you really can't escape. If you're a homosexual, you can't really escape the sex part of who you are. And so I have a big interest in reconciling this sexual aspect of all of us, which is in fact one of the most important principles of the whole world. We'll notice that, you know, all of nature works on a sexual principle. So if you deny sex, you're basically denying all of nature. I think that's a dangerous, foolish thing. I mean, we are sexual beings, and to not integrate that into a religion, a spiritual path, all things holy and good and beautiful, is doing a disservice to our own, you know, inner core being.
Michael, what do you make of the arguments or theories that sometimes get put out online that there is some sort of gay agenda or gay conspiracy?
Well, personally, okay, on one hand, there may very well be a great conspiracy. It's just that I'm not invited to the meetings, so, you know, I don't really know about it. But considering my take on this, the Jungian idea that of the shadow side being reconciled, and these archetypes coming up from the surface into the sun, I would say that the great gay conspiracy is actually a conspiracy of ourselves, where our dark side is conspiring to bring out of the closet our own erotic nature.
So where do you think a reintegration of our missing phallus will lead us in the future?
Well, I hope that it will, well, in the short term, I think is what we're already seeing is a relaxing of social mores that which is very difficult and troubling on the short term, but I think on a long term can only be good. If you think back to, say, Victorian era, or the Puritans, you know, I think this is a good thing. But on a more sync level, I kind of think that when Osiris gets his phallus back, he's finally a whole god once again. That means our consciousness is whole once again. And as far as the way I read the Egyptian myth is Horus represents this whole person again. And he's the son of Osiris. Osiris defeats Set, defeats the subconscious. And it's interesting because there's a lot of stories about the battles of Horus and Set over all this. And one of the things that, one of the aspects of Set that Horus admires is his great strength. And this is because, like I mentioned before, the Kundalini, the base or root of the Kundalini, comes from very deep and lower aspects of the chakra. So if you integrate that in, it just makes sense to me that you will become, that it might actually represent a dawning of an age of a new human being, often called a Superman. Batman becomes Superman, in other words.
That's funny. That's what you talk about in your chapter for the Sync book, this idea that Batman is definitely the Dark Knight. He's going through the Dark Night of the Soul. He is the id. And there's very much, you see, this need to bring that out of the darkness into the light. I just want to kind of bring this full circle, this idea that of what you deny, how it manifests in other ways. Do you see a correlation between this and, say, like church scandals and, whether that be in the Catholic Church or these fundamentalists?
Yeah, it's almost so obvious that it doesn't even need to be talked about. But yeah, the Catholic Church, horrendous sex crimes against children and others, and yet also in total denial about sexuality in general, and especially homosexuality. There's this crazy story about George Allen Reckers, who is a Baptist and a founding member of the Family Research Council with James Dobson. And he was caught returning home from a European vacation way back in May 2010 with a young man he had hired on rentboy.com. It's that kind of really amazing behavior that I believe is caused by his dark side. And if you can integrate these aspects of ourselves and see them not as dark, but as a necessary and wonderful part of ourselves, we're all just going to be so much further ahead.
Well, there is one more person in this community who I know does not shy away from talking about the need to be in touch with ourselves and to touch ourselves. That's Andros Jones, the host of Radio 8-Ball. Please join me in welcoming him now.
Hi, I'm Ray Dawn Chong, and you're listening to Radio 8-Ball with Andros Jones.
Hi, Michael. Yes, it's true. I'm a wanker. And
hi, Andros.
And welcome to the Radio 8-Ball segment of this synchronized episode, where we answer questions by picking songs at random and interpreting those randomly chosen songs as the answers to the questions, like picking musical tarot cards. And What's your question for the Pop Oracle?
Well, I'll say is, since we're talking about Michelle Schacht and my weird connection to her name, I'll just ask, is Michelle Schacht right? Is Jesus going to come back when gays have the right to marry?
Well, that's perfect, because knowing that we were going to be discussing Michelle Schacht, I chose her discography to use as our oracle fodder for this divination. So I'm just going to press shuffle function, and we'll let her answer your question about her, just to make it even more confusing. Here
perfect.
We go.
Photograph, she would have a wide grin. But no, it was an artist with a long and loving style. So when the paint was dry, all that remained was a faint, strange smile. She's ripe with broken dreams, her lovers never stay. It looks like Mona Lisa is having a bad day. Mona Lisa's having a bad day. Nothing better than to rob the Louvre blind. Baroque and complicated, her lovers never stay. It looks like Mona Lisa is having a bad day. Mona Lisa is having a bad day. So please just go away. Just go away.
And that was Michelle Schacht from her 1989 CD, Captain Swing, and the song Looks Like Mona Lisa. The answer to Michael's question, was Michelle Schacht right that...
gay marriage.
And that gay marriage would lead to the return of Jesus. Michael, what do you think about that as your answer?
It couldn't have been more perfect. In fact, I don't even think I need to add anything from what Michelle wrote. I mean, the very fact that it's Mona Lisa, who is, I'll just call her, you know, Leonardo's Isis. And she's got a secret smile, or she's having a bad day, according to, you know, according to Michelle. And I can't help but remember this hilarious rumor that that I heard, that the reason that she has this smile is because it's actually a self-portrait of Leonardo in drag. And that would be a bad day, because he couldn't let his inner homosexuality out at the time, and yet here he is painting it in front of the whole world. So not that that's just a myth, you know, all I'm saying.
Well, we're in the realm of of reflections and what it makes us think. So there's nothing's off limits. in Radio 8 Ball musical divination, or in the realm of sync at all. What I noticed, what I thought was very funny, was right at the beginning it said, if she had it to do all over again. And I just was thinking about all of the flack that Michelle Schacht got for what she said. If she had it to do all over again, it would be a photograph. She would have a wide grin. And it just made me think of, you know, how her words got potentially misinterpreted. And how I guess I have to imagine how gratifying it would be to her to know that there, beyond that, the media or Facebook firestorm around it, around her comments, that there are people with nuanced attention who are able to decode what she may have meant. I want a full disclosure here. As a musician, I've played on bills with Michelle Schacht. I've known her around. I've also been a fan of hers for a long time. So like you, I have a feeling that she was trying to make a weirder point than a soundbite can capture.
Right.
She has a history of being a very mercurial performer and melting down in a myriad of ways on stage. And this just seemed like, well, as you say, in the context of that you've built around it for us here, that it's perfect.
Yeah, it almost seems, when things like that happen, I actually don't think that the performer has any conscious control over what they're saying. It's almost as if the subconscious took over. And this is what the subconscious wanted to say, damn it. And it wanted to say it on Osiris Day. And, you know, look out, Jesus is coming when gays can get married. But it's funny.
Well, the final lines of the song are, but in between her cracks, you can read between the lines. She'd love nothing better than to rob the Louvre blind. Which I think is a lot of what you were getting at in terms of, you know, trying to read between the cracks and between the lines of what she's saying. And to get that the artistic spirit is troublesome, is tricksterish, is the thief. Who would steal the painting of themselves, would rather steal the painting of themselves than, you know, watch it sit there for, you know, people to walk by and take pictures of.
Yeah, I think that's a good, great insight. I mean, you called her Mercurial, Mercury, the messenger, also the thief and the teacher. So I think that all fits with... Michelle Schacht.
Perfect.
In the very first verse that you mentioned where she says, if she had it to do over again, which, as you mentioned, plays on this idea of the second coming, but there's also the idea where she says she would have smiled rather than being, but instead the painter portrayed her as this sort of only half smile. It seemed the idea that we've been talking about, the idea of what is actually in the subconscious, your id, your unexpressed desires, that humanity is sort of putting the almost frowning face on this figure, but the actual expression that this secret woman inside of Leonardo da Vinci might have wanted to express would be a smile, to be out and open smiling, but it's only the painter's hand that paints it. It's society's eyes that portrays it as something bleak and morbid.
I also want to say that the title of the record, I want to remind you that the title of the record is called Captain Swing. Oh. And there's some...
Is that a like double entendre there?
Well, it's her swing album. Like she's doing all music in the style of like... The conceit of the theme of the record is doing all sort of swing, big bandy kind of style stuff, although that song really wasn't. But then there is, does, and she's on it, and she's sort of like giving on the cover, she's giving a wink with this with this Greek fisherman's cap over her and a match under her, and she just, it does seem like at the time she came out as a musician, I always had the sense that she was that she wasn't playing to a straight crowd, and she wasn't playing as straight, whether or not her public persona, as opposed to, say, someone like, I don't know, Liz Phair, or even Sarah McLachlan, or, that there was something about Michelle Schacht that was particular, you know, sort of queer friendly.
Right.
That was, you know, growing up in Olympia, that's what I got from it. And I thought, oh, well, this is a breath of fresh air. This is, like, she's a mainstream artist who seems like Girls from Olympia.
Right.
And that was before Girls from Olympia took the eyes out of their names and became the Girls.
Right.
She was a proto girl, and I guess she still is. She's biting the head off her own audience.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. We'll see where she goes with that. But she certainly has been a great sync fodder for our talk. And thank you, Michelle, very much for that.
And thank you, Michael, for being a part of Synchronize. Listeners can find more of his work at gosporn.blogspot.com.
This is Douglas Bowles from 42 Minutes, and you're listening to Synchronize with Andras Jones and Alan Green, a production of SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Oh, I see what you're
doing. All right, take two. Here we go.
Really?
I have to do a couple of these. I feel like a D-I-C-K for not... I mean, it was a couple of weeks ago that he asked for these from us, Will.
I sent one in.
No so way.
I did now. I care for like a couple of things.
All right.
Joe's was badass.
Yeah, it was. This is what I'm like the standard. This is Douglas Bowles, the Goblin King of Winter's Labyrinth, and you're listening to Synchronize, a production of SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Up next, a writer who goes by the name Zenor reads an incredible essay of his about the Japanese film Funeral Parade of Roses. I highly recommend you check out more of Zenor's work at groupnameforgrapejuice.blogspot.com.
The 2006 DVD release of director Toshio Matsumoto's 1969 debut feature film, The Funeral Parade of Roses, has over the past few years generated a renewed fascination for this lost classic of Japanese New Wave film. This film, in its presentation of the gay and psychedelic subcultures of late 1960s Tokyo, and in its transgressive depictions of sex, violence, radical politics, and avant-garde filmmaking, is truly a portal back to a very different era. The film's supposed influence on Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange is by now almost common knowledge among lovers of strange films. The similarities in style and mood of the two films is immediately obvious. The sped-up scenes accompanied by ironic music of fighting drag queens in parade and menage a trois sex in clockwork, the rival gangs, the excessive lifestyles of the gay boys and the droogs have been noted and compared numerous times. A less often explored comparison, though, is that of theme. An explicit source for Funeral Parade of Roses is the myth of Oedipus, specifically Sophocles' tragedy, Oedipus Rex. In both the myth and the play, Oedipus is destined to murder his father and marry his mother. Despite the best efforts of both Oedipus and his parents to avoid this fate, the inevitable occurs. On finally discovering the truth, his mother, Jocasta, commits suicide and Oedipus blinds himself. This myth was the basis, of course, for what Freud called the Oedipus complex, perhaps best summed up by the song The End by The Doors. Father, yes, son, I want to kill you, and mother, I want to rape you. Eddie, the young transvestite protagonist, played by the real-life Shinjuku gay bar dancer Peter, in his debut on the big screen, is clearly Oedipus. And, at the slight risk of spoiling an unspoilable film, Funeral Parade is at first viewing an inversion of the classical myth. Eddie kills his mother and sleeps with his father. When the truth is finally revealed, the father kills himself and Eddie stabs in his own eyes. In a closer viewing, though, we find that this inversion is only apparent. Eddie has flashbacks of his father abusing him as a child and later abandoning he and his mother. When Eddie suggests to his mother that she forget her departed husband because she has him, which is the classical Oedipal outcome, his mother laughs in his face, causing deep trauma. Later, when Eddie finds his mother making love with another man, Eddie stabs and kills the man, the surrogate father, and then slays his mother, sitting on her supine body and stabbing downward in a manner clearly resembling rape. Leda, the mama son of the gay bar that Eddie much later becomes a hostess at, as his boss and as the lover of his actual father, becomes his surrogate mother. Her own suicide, followed by that of his father and Eddie's own blinding, completes the mythic cycle. A Clockwork Orange can also be seen as a reworking of the myth of Oedipus. Alex, the film's anti-hero, takes on several father figures, perhaps because his own biological father is shown as being a weak and powerless man. This theme is even more explored in Anthony Burgess's original novel. The principal father figure is the writer F. Alexander, who takes an abused Alex into his house, initially not knowing that Alex and his droogs had brutally raped his wife 2 years before, eventually leading to her death. In the novel, Alexander is the author of a manuscript called A Clockwork Orange, and so, in a sense, he is Anthony Burgess himself, a writer whose own wife was beaten and raped by four American GI deserters during the war. Kubrick alludes to this connection by including the word Burgess in a brief shot of one of the newspaper headlines announcing the attack on Alexander's house. Like a funeral parade of roses, A Clockwork Orange is also a story of the eye, a tale of perception. Alexander's eyes are forced to witness the brutal violation of his wife, just as Alex's eyes are pried open by the state during his Ludovico treatment and forced to view horrific acts of violence on screen. By blinding himself, Eddie, like Oedipus, attempts to negate all that he has seen and done. Alex and Alexander, son and father, are forcibly compelled against their will to witness the ultra-violence of their time. Both films center on the eye. Alex's right eye is accentuated by false eyelashes, another visual motif that Kubrick directly borrows from Matsumoto. In fact, Matsumoto's short film, released immediately before Funeral Parade and using some of the same footage, is called For My Damaged Right Eye. Alex has stylized eyeballs on the cuffs of his shirt, the eye on the right featured prominently on the iconic movie poster. In an interview, Toshio Matsumoto discusses his desire to transform perception in his films and in Funeral Parade of Roses most notably. He explains that all art, even the most subversive, eventually becomes formulated and co-opted into the system. He points out that even the law of perspective in painting is an institutional system. It conditions the way that we perceive both art and the world, and it is now so commonplace that it is almost entirely unquestioned. The role of the real artist is to challenge and overthrow all such institutions of perception. This extreme viewpoint was prominent in the late 60s, a period Matsumoto considers to be the most radical since the 1920s. The global student movement, radiating outward from Nanterre in Paris in May of 68, existentially challenged the political and social establishment. This in turn sparked off an even deeper revolutionary movement, the desire to negate all forms of power, even those unexamined forms within our own act of perceiving the world and ourselves. He admits that during the making of Funeral Parade that his main concern was to devour the system. In his own words, "Anyway, that's how I started to think, and also about how to devour the system. As a political problem, the system is not only the power that oppresses people in this or that way, or visible forms of political repression. Power is also what systematizes our thought, feelings, art, and culture in invisible ways. If we don't become aware of this and shake its foundations, we cannot move the structure of power in a real sense. That's why we came to be controlled by more invisible things, like human consciousness, feelings, points of view, or values. I thought that the most pressing issue facing art was how to become aware of this and work to undermine the system as a form of customary inertia. Films that startle and arouse self-awareness of that kind of internal distortion change the condition of cinema itself. This, I think, is art's form of struggle against authority. In Matsumoto's view, power will eventually systematize all modes of thinking and perceiving. Art will always be absorbed and neutralized in this way. And sync, of course, is no exception to this. Art, if it is to be anything at all, is a continual process of desystematization. It constantly challenges and overcomes the boundaries of perception. If it does not do this, we are soon enslaved. Funeral Parade of Roses challenges boundaries by breaking the so-called fourth wall. The characters in the film reveal that they are simultaneously the subjects of a real-life documentary. In A Clockwork Orange, in the book more so than the movie, this wall is breached by having the book, A Clockwork Orange, itself appear in the narrative. In a chapter in Burgess's book, Alex is able to read a selection of Alexander's manuscript. Alexander describes here how people are as fruit hanging on a great tree of life planted and tended by God. In the modern era, though, God has withdrawn, and human individuals are on the verge of becoming machines, clockwork oranges. The true God, the original Father, is absent from the world, and we are now dominated by different patriarchal authority, scientific mechanization, and the state and the elite who profit from this system. It's interesting that a similar point of view is expressed by the character of the fool in a famous scene within Akira Kurosawa's 1985 epic film Ran. The fool is also played by Peter in his most well-known role since Funeral Parade of Roses. On the battlefield at the death of his master Hidetora, Kurosawa's King Lear, Kyoami the fool laments that there are no gods or Buddha. He cries, "If you exist, hear me. You are mischievous and cruel. Are you so bored up there that you must crush us like ants? Is it such fun to see men weep?" The fool is wise, just as Oedipus's advisor, the blind Tiresias, was the only man who could truly see. We are all subject to the spiteful caprices of the god of this world, manifesting as an evil destiny to Eddie and appearing as conservative or liberal representatives of the establishment to Alex. This appears to be the final father to slay. Georges Bataille's 1928 novella, The Story of the Eye, is a likely influence on both Funeral Parade and Clockwork. Its grotesque episodes of total transgression are in excess of those in both movies. The 20s were more radical than the 60s. The book's climax, a violent orgy in a church involving the brutal murder of a priest and the use of his eyeball in the sexual rites, aims at total sensory and conceptual liberation. Bataille, and this text in particular, went on to become a major influence on the generation of May 68 in France. Radical theorists Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari often cite Bataille as an influence, and it was these two who launched a direct assault on Freud's doctrine of the Oedipus complex. In their seminal 1972 text, Anti-Oedipus, they assert that Freudian psychoanalysis, in its effort to resolve the Oedipus complex, is really only a tool by capitalism and the state to make the individual members of the nuclear family repress their own desires and conform to the organizing principles of society. The familial father is neutralized, but he is replaced by a much more powerful patriarch. The titles of Funeral Parade of Roses and A Clockwork Orange hint at a repression and oppression that can only be called Gnostic in its depth and malevolence. Both roses and oranges are solar symbols, and the demiurge has always been identified with the sun. A funeral parade, or funeral parades, plurality is not indicated in Japanese, is a procession of death. A clockwork mechanism is similarly the endless unwinding of dead matter. Neither the rose nor the orange nor even the sun are essentially negative images. Each contains vitality and freedom of expression. The eye is also a symbol of the sun. These symbols have all been co-opted by the system of control, but this does not need to be the case. Liberating symbols can again be liberated. William Blake in particular recognized this. Blake wrote in his epic poem Jerusalem that a man's worst enemies are those of his own house and family. Blake understood, like Deleuze and Guattari, like Bataille, and like Kubrick and Matsumoto, that the conformist, authoritarian, life-stifling will of society is most effectively brought down on the visionary artist by the close family. It is our parents, our siblings, our spouses, children, and closest friends, not the police or government or other figures of authority, who most intimately pressure us to give up our wild dreams, to rein in and snuff out our creative imagination. It is the nuclear Oedipal family that most limits our vision. Blake called this limitation the single vision, in contrast to the double vision of imagination. He most famously illustrated this with his image of the sun. He wrote, "When the sun rises, do you not see a round disk of fire, somewhat like a guinea? Oh, no, no, I see an innumerable company of the heavenly host, crying, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty.'" The prosaic guinea sun is what the Oedipal family, what the authoritarian state with its materialist ideology wants us to see. To see anything else is to be, by definition, crazy. The doors of perception must be kept firmly closed. The power system is well aware that the only escape from the reign of clockwork, from the endless procession of funerals, is through the eye. In the two films, this escape does not appear to have happened. Certainly in A Clockwork Orange, it does not. Alex's eyes are wide open to the violence of this world, but they are blind to any deeper vision. He becomes an agent and pawn of the same authoritarian state that tormented him. He remains a slave to the god of this world. In general, in this film, Kubrick appears to portray the reactionary establishment forces as being supreme. Despite its surface transgression, there is no liberation in A Clockwork Orange. Funeral Parade of Roses is more promising. The hope and possibility of liberation is present throughout the movie. It is subversive, while A Clockwork Orange is reactionary. Eddie blinds himself in the end, but does he, like Oedipus eventually, come to see a higher vision? Does his blindness, like that of Oedipus, finally end the cycle? The tale of Oedipus is not even unique in Greek myth. The same story is ubiquitous. The primal god Uranus is castrated by his son Cronus or Saturn, who is in turn overthrown by his son Zeus or Jupiter. In every case, it is the mother goddess who spurs on her son to bring down his father. The controlling system is really Oedipal and not exclusively patriarchal. The mother, like Eddie's mother in Funeral Parade, laughs in our faces, causing us to doubt our virility, traumatizes us. The myth seems to change, though, with the present Archon. Jupiter is Jove, or Jehovah, and his son is Christ. Christ rejects the world represented by his mother, but he also uniquely declares that I and my father are one. The Oedipal cycle is finally overturned. It does not continue. It is finished. Only its illusion remains, and illusion is what double vision dissipates. We already possess the Father's kingdom within. In contrast, to have eyes wide open in this world, as sightless Tiresias attempted to teach Oedipus, is to be truly blind. Blake is a Christian Gnostic anarchist. Toshio Matsumoto is also, in a certain sense. We do not need, of course, to slay or reject or even resent our families in order to free our imagination. To do so, in fact, only perpetuates this system of control, this nightmare of history. We do need, as Matsumoto, Blake, Bataille, and so many others revealed, to open all the doors of perception. These visionaries, appearing as blind or crazy to the world, are those who can teach us to truly see.
This is Rodney Asher, director of Room 237, and you're listening to Think Book Radio.
A number of years back, I read a blog post by Christopher Knowles, author of secretsun.blogspot.com, where he pointed out the many connections between St. Patrick's Day, celebrated on March 17th, and the mythological date of Osiris's death on the 17th day of the third month of the Egyptian calendar. Since then, I've been fascinated by this date and the number 317. It probably doesn't take away from my fascination that on March 17th, 2010, I had what I perceived and experienced as a sort of telepathic contact from the star Sirius, complete with it giving me winning lottery numbers when I asked it for proof. Now, that's probably a strange thing to say without further explanation, but it's a long story and I've told it before. So if you really want to hear it, I'd suggest listening to my appearance on Mike Cleland's Hidden Experience podcast or Anthony Peake's Consciousness Hour. Regardless, this experience obviously fueled much interest and further study. Like Robert Anton Wilson, who I later learned also had a serious communication, I have since equated the whole thing with, among other things, my right brain. A sort of ego death in which I stumbled headfirst into the murky waters of the id. These are the sometimes wonderfully insightful and the sometimes terrifyingly chaotic headspaces of the unconscious. It is from this starting point that I developed a theory that the death of Osiris on 317 and the themes of the King Kill are all very much related to ego death. For those unaware that they are going through this process, it is almost like getting slipped a cosmic roofie, and I imagine it can be very frightening. You would end up battling with your shadow, as well as monsters from the id, and your unconscious projections. So when I first heard about Michelle Schacht having this breakdown on 317, it made a perfect sort of sense. The following is a clip from the Young Turks.
In the past, people would say that she's a lesbian. She never really exactly came out, but she never really denied it. Did you guys know who she was, though?
No, I had no idea. Okay. I still don't know who she is. But I was shocked. Mm-hmm. The minute I heard that she said that, I immediately assumed that she was a closeted lesbian. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm a bad guy. But that, I'm not a bad guy, because that's what happens every time.
That is right. The truth every single time.
Yeah, it's self-projection period. At its worst.
That's it. You know what? This is like Psych 101 to me. This is when you're in the closet, everything that you think is compromised. You don't, because mm-hmm. you're not, it's the closet. You're in this small little right. world instead of the big world that the rest of us live in. Mm-hmm. And then because of that, your every thought that you have is compromised. Every thought that comes from you, that because you're denying yourself something that's the most simple thing of who you're attracted right. to. So every thought that you have, every idea you have, comes with this attachment. It comes with this tag.
Because your identity, this that's
is, yeah, your identity yeah. is so crippled in your own mind, not in reality.
Okay, the id is a land of both fears and desires, and Michelle Schacht is a lesbian afraid of her own sexuality. But let's take this a little further. Michelle Schacht sees the coming world of gay marriage as an apocalyptic vision. We should remember here that the word apocalypse means unveiling. The ego, Osiris, has died, and Isis is unveiled. She goes on to talk about Jesus coming back. This is the return of the King of Kings and a rebirth of the solar god. So the myth of Osiris and Horus continues to play out. Next, let us consider that Michelle Schacht focused on Twitter throughout her set and kept telling people to tweet about the things she said. Well, in this Egyptian thread we are following, let us think of the little blue bird of Twitter as the Ba bird.
The Ba is an aspect of a person that the Egyptians believed would live after the body had died, and it is sometimes depicted as a human-headed bird flying out of the tomb to join with the Ka in the afterlife.
The Ba bird is often associated with Isis, particularly in scenes where the Ba bird, carrying an Ankh, revives the dead Osiris, as compared to the scenes where Isis, in the form of a hawk carrying the replacement golden phallus she fashioned to procreate with her dead husband, revives Osiris. It is through this act that Horus is conceived. Again, the introduction of a new solar deity or the return of a renewed one. This takes us to Zenor's audio essay on Funeral Parade of Roses and the Oedipal themes within. But first, I must point out the sink of Zenor's latest blog post at groupnameforgrapejuice.blogspot.com being about the significance of the number 731 for the Japanese people, 731 being another arrangement of the numbers 317. Okay, now, as to Oedipus, we have a king with his eyes removed, and in Funeral Parade we have a young gay man who also removes his eyes. This is significant for many reasons, not the least of which being the Egyptian themes of homosexuality and incest in the myth where Horus, battling his uncle after the death of his father, must deal with Set trying to trick him into eating his semen. Then there's the removal of the eyes themselves. Wikipedia tells us the following about Horus.
His right eye was associated with the sun god Ra. The left eye sometimes represented the moon and the god Thoth. In one myth, when Set and Horus were fighting for the throne after Osiris's death, Set gouged out Horus's left eye, the moon eye. When Horus's eye was recovered, he offered it to his father, Osiris, in hopes of restoring his life. Hence, the eye of Horus was often used to symbolize sacrifice, healing, restoration, and protection.
Though we could split hairs as to whether or not the Eye of Horus is the same as the Eye of Ra, what is more important for this conversation is the realization that, for the Egyptians, the severed eyes had a consciousness and were able to act on their own. The eye is also significantly feminine. However, this feminine eye can be not only protective and restoring, but also a notably destructive feminine energy, which will be important when we factor in the Indian variations on these myths.
The eye goddess acts as mother, sibling, consort, and daughter to the sun god. She is his partner in the creative cycle in which he begets the renewed form of himself that is born at dawn. The eye's violent aspect defends Ra against the agents of disorder that threaten his rule. Ra's enemies are the forces of chaos, which threaten the cosmic order that he creates. This dangerous aspect of the eye goddess is often represented by a lioness or cobra, a symbol of protection and royal authority.
This eye, in its violent form, in its role as battling agents of disorder and chaos, and as a symbol of royal authority, can be found in the statements of Michel Schacht and many of our authoritarian systems. While the standard cycle goes from ego to the chaotic id back to a restored ego, if this restored ego views the chaos as an enemy rather than an educational experience and an ally to integrate into a more holistic being or system, the ego can lash out and become fixated on destroying perceived enemies. Here again, we are confronted with a desire to overturn patriarchal power structures, Oedipus killing the father, and the juxtaposed desire to return to stable ground and the temporary comfort of order out of chaos.
And so she's going through the same thing, like, I'm a lesbian, I'm a capital F fornicator. Oh no, Jesus, I'm so sorry, I read the Bible again, oh, I hate gay people. And then the next minute she's back to being gay, and the next minute she's back to be hating gay people,
but
that's because she keeps feeling guilty.
The solar eye's volatility can make her a difficult entity. In another myth, the eye goddess becomes upset with Ra and runs away from him, becoming as uncontrolled as the forces of chaos she is meant to subdue. When the goddess is at last placated, her return marks the beginning of the inundation and the new year, because the eye can be equated with the star Sothis, which we call Sirius. Every summer, at the start of the Egyptian year, Sirius's heliacal rise heralded the start of the Nile inundation. Therefore, the Eye of Ra precedes and represents the floodwaters that restore fertility to all of Egypt. The pacified eye deity is once more a procreative consort for the sun god. In many cases, the eye goddess and her consort then produce a divine child who becomes the new sun god. The goddess's transformation from hostile to peaceful is a key step in the renewal of the sun god and the kingship that he represents.
At this point, all of our pieces are coming together. Just as the Egyptians associated Isis with the star Sirius, so too did they think of Sirius in terms of this self-aware eye. And while the symbolism here deals with the death and rebirth of a solar king, it is also distinctly feminine in nature.
The characteristics of the Eye of Ra were an important part of the Egyptian concept of female divinity. As the patron goddess Wajet, she was depicted as a snake-headed woman or a snake. Her name means risen one, from the image of a cobra rising up in protection.
It is here, with the image of a rising snake, that we come to the concept of Kundalini, also a rising serpent. Amazingly, not only did Michelle Schacht have this experience on 317, the date of Osiris's death, and not only does she share a name similarity with Michael Schacht, but this name similarity points us to the very word used to describe the experiences we are talking about, a word that encompasses all of these themes and archetypes, Shakti. While Shakti can be thought of as an all-pervasive force or the supreme being, it can also be thought of as embodied goddesses, such as Parvati or Kali. This again presents us with the full spectrum of feminine energies, from love and devotion to primal chaos and destruction. Just as Kali went on such a rampage that she became unable to stop or direct her anger, so too would it seem Michelle Schacht lashed out blindly while bathed in the Sirius moonlight.
The Kundalini can also awaken spontaneously, triggered by intense personal experiences such as accidents, near-death experiences, childbirth, emotional trauma, extreme mental stress, what have you. A spontaneous awakening in one who is unprepared can result in an experience which has been termed the Kundalini crisis, or a spiritual emergency, or the Kundalini syndrome. The symptoms are said to resemble those of a Kundalini awakening, but are experienced as unpleasant, overwhelming, or out of control.
Experiences like this might be avoided if we start to address some of what we're really wrestling with inside. The ego death or king kill is a wake-up call, an opening of the eye in the sky, as well as the impulse to pluck it out. The death of our solar gods is a smashing of the heavenly clockwork. Perhaps it is an attempt at breaking free of the cycle known as samsara. Even though I see the id and the chaos as necessary components, and I hope I haven't demonized them at all, the goal of these transformative experiences is individuation, not absorption into a collective or conformity. If you only receive one cosmic transmission this year, one that asks you to come to terms with your sexuality and individual nature, wouldn't be a bad choice. Thank you so much for joining us today on Synchronize. If you enjoyed this program, visit thesyncbook.com, where you can find archives of all the Syncbook radio shows, subscribe on iTunes, donate to keep the shows going, and find links to all our guests' websites. We also have two other weekly shows, 42 Minutes, which airs every Tuesday, and Always Record, which airs every Thursday. At thesyncbook.com, you can find both of these podcasts, as well as links to purchase copies of the Sync books. If you get your Sync books from Amazon, be sure to leave a review there. Amazon reviews help people find our work and helps get the word out. Please share these episodes with your friends and like the Sync book on Facebook. Thanks again to all our contributors and guests, and thanks to all the listeners.